from a research standpoint, you know, the one thing this place excels at is, you know, can we consistently make good feed? And when I say, you know, obviously good feed, most people are like, okay, quality ingredients, your corn, you know, we make, you know, on paper, this is the diet they want. When we get done and they sample that feed, our feed is pretty close to what they calculated on paper.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/AG. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Welcome, everybody, to the Feed Science Podcast brought to you by Wisenetics. I am Carlos Campabadal from Kansas State University, dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussion from the feed science industry. Please get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead in today's episode. So today, I'm very happy to have as a guest Mike Seltwanger, who is the feed mill manager at Purdue University Animal Science Research and Education Center. You know, I'm a Purdue alumni, so I was happy to have people from Purdue. Mike, welcome. Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast, and we're very happy to have you here. Just to kind of hit it off and the audience to know who you are, if you don't mind, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself first, and then we'll start from there.
Hi, well, thank you. Appreciate you for having me on. I am also a Purdue grad. I graduated in 94 with a undergrad degree. Started working at the animal science farms actually while I was a student. And then we were doing a clinical trial at the dairy for Eli Lilly to get Monensin approved. So they hired me on there and I stayed on there, worked. The animal science farms consists of a dairy, beef, swine, poultry, sheep, farm operations. So I, over the last, 30 plus years, I've worked at every place but poultry and sheep, I guess. So I've been the manager of the feed mill since 2012.
Okay.
Yeah, almost. Right at 13 years going on, not quite 13 years. So.
Great.
So it's been a learning, a lot of learning going on in the last 30 years.
Oh, I bet, you know, and it seems that you have a vast experience in many species, of course, and all the great work that at Purdue University, the Animal Science Department, and I'm pretty sure collaborated with others, have done. And very interesting that I hear you, the trials to approve Monensin there, Eli Lilly, of course, Elanco now these days. I mean, so based on that work overall that you did as a student, so what triggered you a little bit to continue to stay there at Purdue and kind of went that path overall?
That's kind of, it was not, you know, if you had asked me when I graduated, if I thought I was going to be here in 30 years, I probably would have said no. But I will say agriculture, I didn't grow up on a farm. My dad moved off of the farm he owned when I was two. But I had, my dad's the youngest of 10 or 11 kids, and my mom's the youngest of three, and all my uncles farmed. My mom's older brother had a dairy farm in Iowa. And when I was a kid, that was like my favorite place on earth was to go to his farm. 'Cause he had four daughters. They were older than me. And I was the lone son that he didn't have. And I got a lot of love, and I got a lot of, leeway, shall we say, on, you know, getting to experience the farm, but not being the son of the farmer. So, I do attribute that a lot to my kind of love for agriculture. But yeah, when I first graduated Purdue, I thought I was going to go into teaching and coaching, and, I don't know. I just never really panned out to do the teaching. I did coach for several years, and that staying here and allowed me to do that and, you know, stay involved in agriculture. So,
and for our audience, please like us there on our podcast here. Give us the famous thumbs up. So Mike, very interesting. I mean, just to kind of like for our audience to learn a little bit about, can you kind of like tell us a little bit of the day to day activities that the feed mill at Purdue do? I mean, what is their role, of course, connected to the animal science department and others? And then we'll go from there, because I'm pretty sure that the audience might be interested what a research feed mill does on a university feed mill does day to day, and of course your day to day activities. I mean, at the end of the day, that's always very important to learn, especially for future professionals.
So for the most part, we have a 200 sow farrow to finish swine farm. You know, I provide all the feed. A good, like from a volume standpoint, most of what I make is, you know, doesn't have anything to do with research other than we're raising these pigs. I make a little bit of feed for dairy, the supplement. You know, I'm not doing the TMR. Occasionally make some things for beef, poultry. We make all the poultry feed. The poultry is a little different. We generally only have birds on hand while we're doing a research project. We do have a relatively small flock of laying hens almost all the time. But for the most part, if we don't have birds on research, we don't have them. I make a little bit of sheep feed, but a majority of the tonnage I make is for swine. And, you know, the... For the females out there that are pushing 4,000 or 5,000 tons a week, I'm right around 2,200 to 2,300 tons in a year. So we're, you know, substantially, you know, less, smaller on volume than, you know, most of the more modern mills. From a research standpoint, you know, the one thing this place excels at is, you know, can we consistently make good feed? And when I say, you know, obviously good feed, most people are like, okay, quality ingredients, your corn, you know. We make, you know, on paper, this is the diet they want. When we get done and they sample that feed, our feed is pretty close to what they calculated on paper. I have three different mixers. I can mix a ton and a half batch of feed. I can mix a ton. And then I have four. I have a small 600-pound mixer. And then we have a 150-pound, I think it was used for mixing sausage, you know, at some point. We use it for feed. Mm-hmm. And so between those four mixes, you know, we can make, I've made research diets as big as, you know, ton and a half, or three or four tons, several batches. We've made research diets as small as 50 pounds.
Wow. Okay.
So that's kind of the, you know, obviously I feel like we're good at making production feed for the facilities that we have, but we're not, you know, I'm sure you've been in feed mills that they're making 5,000 tons a week. I can't come close to that, but we can make a wide variety of smaller diets, 500 pounds, 1,000 pounds, and generally the feed we make is, you know, really good quality, not only in corn and, you know, the ingredients going in, but the fact that we're pretty close to what's on paper generally. So, and that's, you know, this place was built in 1975, 76. You know, I was five when that happened, so I can't. You know, I just kind of took over a place that was already pretty good at what it did. I just, you know, didn't have to screw it. You know, all I had to do is not screw it up too bad. So day to day, you know, Monday through Wednesday, we're kind of making the production feed, taking care of all the swine and the poultry feed production diets we need to make. And then usually, and large part of that's for medications. We don't do a lot of medicated feed, but we do some, so that allows me to sequence through and then get everything to where my mixers are clean. Mm-hmm. And then if, you know, Thursday, usually Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, if there's research diets to be made, that's when we do that. And, you know, those, the frustrating part of that is, you know, I can make, it may take, you know, 4 or 5 hours to make 500 pound research diets. You know, if you're just feeding those group of pigs or chickens, you know, just a normal diet, you know, you can do that in half an hour, but that's just the nature of, you know, what we do.
Yeah, absolutely.
We try to be as productive and, you know, efficient as we can be, but the goal of doing research diets is get them right and, you know, make sure the feed is what was anticipated.
And that is very important. I mean, overall, And I point out here behind my window, but we do have the Kansas State feed mill too. That we have a fairly new one, 12 years old, that came from the.
Yeah, you guys were just finishing that up when I started this job, so.
Yeah, so we had our research one and the animal science one that got combined around that same time, 2012 and 13. So we understand very well the importance of doing small batches for research. Precise, you know, and that's a little bit different when you think about mass production for all those sites of mills that you were mentioning. So for our audience, please, if you learned something new today, please share the video. And going back to that, Mike, so a couple things, you know, to kind of, you could kind of tell us a little bit about what those, you said a lot of medicated feed, but so your overall mill, the diets you guys make and maintenance feed is more on the mash, correct?
Mash. Yeah. If they intended, when they built the place or designed it originally, if they intended of putting in a pellet mill, they didn't do a very good job accounting for adding the necessary, you know, the pellet machine, the, you know, all the things you would need to make pellets. We just make pretty much mash feed all the time. Actually, they built the mill originally. I think it just had the 1-ton ribbon mixer and then the 600-pound paddle mixer.
Okay.
And then in the 84, 85 range, they came back in and added the 1.5-ton paddle mixer. They put in some overhead bins in the drive-through, added a bagging machine, sewing machine. It's kind of like they realized they didn't have the mixing capacity that they needed. So they added that 1.5-ton mixer. And then actually when I started here, the 1.5-ton mixer and the 600-pound mixers, you know, they'd pretty much been using that exclusively. And I don't know for sure how long it'd been since they ran the 1-ton ribbon mixer, but we started using it a couple years after I started here, and that's been a pretty good addition. But I would, you know, like I said, I think probably on a percentage basis, something like 85% of the feed that we make is swine feed. But it's. You know, we're covering all life stages. We gestation feed, we make lactation feed, we make if the nursery pigs, if they're on a research project, we'll make all phases, you know, whatever the research calls for, we'll make all those, that feed. If we have a group that's farrowed that is not going to be on a research project, currently we're feeding them, we're buying a pellet in to feed them for the first 2 weeks.
Okay. And
after that, I make the feed. We're looking at switching to getting a crumble, so then I can make all the, you know, go away from the pellets, use a crumble so I can make all the feed. But, you know, we're progressing in that direction. We're not there yet, but... this is another kind of different from production feed. For a long time, we didn't have the ability of all in, all out in some of our grow finish barns. About 5 years ago, we switched to that. And so now we've been able to do a lot of any medications, you know, on the water lines. Previously, we'd have 2 or 3 different age groups in a grow finish barn, and, you know, pretty hard to medicate the feed or medicate through the water lines. Mm-hmm. When, you know, you've got a 150-pound pig and a 75-pound pig in the same group or in the same barn. So now we've switched that over and we're more all in, all out. And so we've been taking a lot of the medications, like we used to use vancomycin, Tylen. We still use Carbadox in the nursery feed, but we've been able to take a lot of that, some of that out of the feed. So that's made my life a little easier from making feed.
Yeah, of course.
Which I, you know, obviously I'm well in favor of.
So as we move, Mike, on the a little bit on the technical side of things of your feed, I mean, can you comment a little bit? I mean, you guys make a lot of medicated feed, and especially for research purposes, it is very important, and especially for the following batches. So can you tell us a little bit so the audience can understand the procedures and, of course, the importance of the overall how do you make sure that you don't have any residue of any medication on your equipment for the following batch?
This is probably a pretty basic example, I would think, for most of the audience. But, you know, I have to – the students – so I pretty much work here by myself as a full-time employee. So most of the people that help me are all college students. And I do some tours and different things. But one of the examples I use is, you know, if I ask you to make me some cakes, you're going to make me a chocolate cake, a funfetti cake, and a vanilla cake. And you want to mix those batches up, but you want to clean your bowl out any more than you absolutely have to. How do you, you know, there's an order you could make those cakes and minimize how much cleaning you have to do in between. You know, eventually somebody figures it out. Okay, well, you can make the chocolate first, then you have to clean your bowl. Then you make the vanilla, then the funfetti, or, you know, you have to clean the bowl out at some point, but you can minimize it. And so basically that's, you know, sequencing. Anybody that's made a lot of feed or been involved in a feed mill, you know, they understand you sequence that feed. So if you make a medicated diet, the feed you're going to make after that, you know, it's not going to be problematic that those animals get some of that medication. You know, for me, I have the mixers and one feed truck. I don't have holding bins for my feed. You know, we mix the feed. It comes out of the mixer, goes right in the truck.
Okay.
So that simplifies things a little bit for me. I don't have to keep track of, you know, what bin did, you know, that feed came out of the mixer, then it went in this bin, and then it went in, you know, truck one or not truck five or whatever. So I'm pretty thankful for that. I don't have to track all that stuff. But so that is one of the things, like even for the students that work for me, that I spend quite a bit of time on is trying to get them to understand, you know, yeah, we just made a medicated diet now. It's not just the mixer that we have to worry about. In fact, in my opinion, the mixer is probably got the least amount of contamination in it. It's the auger going from the mixer to the leg that then goes into the truck and the auger coming out of the truck. That's where that's where you're really going to pick up some pounds that are, you know, high dosed, high, you know, the stuff that was in the mixer, you're going to thin that down a little bit. But so it's, you know, sequence, make the feed in an order so that, you know, whatever medication is in diet A, it's not going to matter that it's in diet B. And, you know, just move through that. And then, you know, making feed for different species, you know, the one thing I learned intimately while working with dairy cattle is they are very, very efficient at taking anything they ingest and getting it into the milk. So
that's right.
We, you know, I even try to make sure so we start, and anybody that feeds pigs a lot knows this, you're most likely the medicated diets you're going to make for swine are your nursery diets. And then as the pigs get older, they're going to, you know, you're less likely to put any medication in that feed. So on Monday, we start every Monday, we're making our medicated nursery diets, and then we follow the age of the pigs. So, you know, we're going to make several tons of feed that are unmedicated before we switch to either poultry or dairy or, you know, a different species. So, you know, we've run you know, several batches, several tons of feed through everything that has not been medicated to make sure that, you know, we're not carrying anything over into a different species.
And that's very important. And for our audience, of course, please share this video if you learned something new today. I think this overall making sure that equipment is clean, it is always very important. And we see that a lot. So moving on that, just to kind of emphasize a little bit, so sequencing, of course, making sure you have several batches before, something that will be a higher risk. You guys also look into flush batches or something like that, or just to make sure that there's no carryover?
Yeah, if we have to. I mean, for me, if used 90% of the time, actually a little bit more than that, most of the time, if I know on Monday, you know, here's all the feed you're going to make this week, I can sequence through and I don't need to do a flush. Now, as anybody in the feed industry will tell you, is generally speaking, your weeks don't go that smoothly. There's always somebody ran out of feed, or, you know, the drop came out and they dropped a bunch of feed in the pit, or, you know, something happened, something tragic. So, you know, somebody needs something more than what they thought, or, you know, so, and really that's where things can get tricky. Again, for me, I've worked pretty much by myself and I can even do this. You know, somebody comes in, they have a tragic issue. They're out of feed. You know, they weren't expecting it. You need to, you know, can you make feed and how soon can you make it? Well, you want to be helpful. You know, you want to help solve their issues and, you know, okay, yeah, we can do that. We'll make it, you know, next batch. And then, you know, you walk away and go, wait a minute. Wait, okay, hang on a minute. I got a medicated feed in there right now. I can't make that. I got to make something else first. So, you know, and that's for me. I've been dealing with these medications for, you know, 12 years. I know I'm inside and out. So that's always one of my fears is some of the students that, you know, if I happen to be off a day, going to the doctor or vacation or whatever, you know, the students are they're even more, you know, hey, we need to be helpful. And, you know, it's they've got to understand, yeah, you want to be helpful, but the realities are, you can't do this next. And a flush, I would do that. I would do a flush if I need to, but that creates another set of, you got to track that, you know, it's not like you just flush it and then just set off the side. You got to label that. People have to understand what it is. And, you know, when can we use that again? And for me, in my situation, most likely it's going to be a week before I can use that flush material.
That's right. Yeah.
So I will fly. I mean, I know the process, I know the routine, but it does create some challenges in communication and everybody being on the same page of what that is and make sure it's labeled and then you actually get it used. You know, it doesn't just sit in the corner and rot away. So I try pretty hard not to flush anything. We do a flush. I've got a line going to the bagging bin. And we'll run a little bit of corn through there just to make sure that drag conveyor is flushed out. But we just make a habit of, you know, we're using that small amount of corn, right? You know, we're going to use that up in the next batch of feed we make pretty much. So I try to avoid flushes and anything like that as much as I can. Just to, not that I don't want to, you know, A, it is.
No, we understand that. Yeah.
You know, so. It creates a new set of issues.
So in your opinion, if I'm a new feed mill manager or operation person or helping somebody in a feed mill, which equipment will you pay more attention to have any residue of medicated feed? You know, it could be a handling equipment, an elevator or a leg or a conveyor, whatever it is. Which you will always pay more attention than others?
Augers.
Augers. Okay.
And, you know, straight horizontal, a little bit of an angle to it, you know, it doesn't matter. They just don't. Even drag conveyors I have a drag conveyor that sets a little bit of an angle. Mm-hmm. If it was straight horizontal, I probably wouldn't worry that much about it. But, you know, it's funny that when I first started here, I'd had experience with mixtures of dairy. But with the grad students, it was just tradition, like, you know, we're going to make research feed. We're cleaning this mixture. You know, full clean, you know, we're cleaning it out, we're sweeping it out, we're blowing it out. It's going to look, you know, pretty much brand new by the time we're done with this. Well, what I learned was, okay, the kid figured out, okay, I need a ton of feed. Well, okay, great. We clean the mixture out, we make a ton of feed. Well, you only got 1,970 pounds of feed out. Where's the 30? Well, it's stuck in the mixer. You know, it just, it's no different than you making a, you know, batter, cake batter. You make that up and you get it all out. Well, you don't get the bowl completely clean, right? There's still some batter left in there. So, you know, for me, the stuff that's left in the mixer, that's the next batch of feed, you're going to, I actually did the math once. Somebody was worried about the amount of phosphorus in their diets. And so we made the one diet, and then we made the second diet, which was supposed to have a little less phosphorus in it. Well, they wanted to sweep the mixture out. Well, I kept that. The amount we swept out was like 7 or 8 pounds of feed. And then I did the math. I said, okay, well, there was this much phosphorus in that 7 pounds. If it would have been in the mixture and we made the next batch, the very, very, very small percentage of phosphorus difference there that might have added to that second batch. Okay. I mean, it was statistically insignificant.
Statistically insignificant.
So for me, the mixers are, it depends on how old your mixers are. You know, are the, like a paddle mixer, are your paddles set? Are they pretty tight up against the concave?
Yeah.
Right. You know, how much are you leaving in there? And really, how full do you get the mixer when you mix?
That's right. Too. Yeah.
That's one of the things I've learned with people. Most people don't design their research projects around my mixing capacities. They design them, okay, this many pigs, we're going to have this many pens, this many pens.
Right.
Yeah. And then they come to me and say, well, we need to make 800 pounds of feed. Or 700 pounds of different diets. And I'm like, well, that's the worst that I can't put that in my 600 pound mixer. I don't think it's enough for my 1 ton mixer. And it sure isn't enough for my ton and a half mixer. Like mix 600 pounds or mix 1,000 pounds. Don't mix, you know, 700 is like the worst yeah. amount for me. Right. But you see when you're mixing, you see that. The effects of not having the mixture full. Like if you only put 200-300 pounds in there, you go, it's not doing anything. But you get the right amount of feed in there and it's working.
Not gonna work well.
So back to your question on an auger, as that auger empties, you know, it starts leaving that trail depending on how much space there is between the bottom of the auger and the flighting. Well, as it starts to empty, it's going to leave that. So the auger I have that goes from my mixer to the leg it's about 20 feet. And they put doors in the bottom of it so you can drop that and clean that out. Well, I've did that. There's about 2.5 pounds every 2 feet. Those doors are 2 foot wide. So now 20 feet, you're talking, you know, that's 40 pounds of feed. If that's a medicated, say, at 100 grams of lincomycin, that's, you know. So then you think about, it's going to go, that feed is going to be the first, because the next batch of feed you run through there, it's going to push that whole 40, right? It's not going to blend in. It's going to push that whole 40.
That's right.
It's going to end up in the bottom of your truck. Well, and the truck's got the same thing. It's going to have another 40, 60 pounds of linco feed at 100 grams. So the next bin you go to, if that bin is empty, the first thing that's going in the bottom of that bin is somewhere around 70, 80 pounds of fully medicated 100 gram per ton feed. That's problematic, right? If I put that in a dairy bin, we are going to have we're going to dump our milk. That's going to be a problem.
That's right.
Now, if I took 20 pounds of medicated feed of Linco feed and still in my mixer, and I mix a ton and a half of feed in there, I mean, I don't go through and do the bath on that, but I have very severely reduced the amount of lincomycin that's in that ton and a half of feed. I still wouldn't like it. I still wouldn't do it, but that's the stuff that I've learned as I've worked here is the highest risk contamination is not really in your mixer. The only thing I would say that would be like Menensin. We talked about Menensin. I worked on that study, and it was that study. Just to give you an example, give you an idea, 96 cows were on that study at one point. It took three people. If everything went perfectly, three people in 8 hours to feed those 96 plus the remaining 110 cows are on the farm. Three people, 8 hours to feed everybody. It was extensive. But anyway, I didn't realize at the time, I do now that I've mixed Rumensin and feed, like the cow ends up with like a half a gram to a gram of Rumensin daily. I think the idea is you're going to get an extra 10% of milk production. So Rumensin is that's one that you got to watch, right? If a half a gram or somewhere between half a gram to a gram per head per day affects a cow, you know, that's a powerful medication or a powerful thing.
Yes.
You know, it's a little different. Like calcium, if it's cheap. It's if I go over 10 pounds of calcium,
not that bad. Yeah.
You go over a little bit on Menensin or something like that. No, that's a bigger problem.
It is a bigger problem. So
anyway, to answer your question, I feel like people want to say mix. You know, my mixture. Oh, that's the big contamination area.
And a lot of people do. Yeah.
And I'm not saying it can't be, but it's everything after whatever, you know, from whatever stuff you got to go from your mixer to your storage bin or your truck, that's far more likely to be problematic than what you mix in the mixer is actually going to get diluted. That in that auger or the leg or in the truck, that stuff's not going to, that's going to get in the bin and that's going to be undiluted feed. So I'm certainly not an expert on this, but that's from my experience, what I've seen, that to me is the highest risk.
And I agree with you. And this is great advice for our audience. And of course, if they have any questions, please leave it there in the comment section and we'll make sure to send it there to Mike.
It's time for our famous three.
Very important topic overall, and I think that's something very good that we come up. I mean, especially when you're looking from a research facility that is using medication and everything with that. So thank you, Mike, for that. And as we're getting close to the end of our time here for the podcast and with great technical information from Mike based on his experience, but Mike, if you have somebody that wants to learn more about overall feed manufacturing, research diets, I mean, where do you guide? It could be one of your students or anybody there that is starting a career. Where to look for information? I mean, where do you send them to look?
I'm sending them to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks.
I'm not really not trying to kiss anybody's butt, but you know, you guys have set the standard on you know. I knew she doesn't work there anymore, but I knew somebody that a student was at Purdue. She was a recruiter for ADM for a while, and she was recruiting for Midwest and you know Indiana, Ohio, and you know she would call me and say, "Hey, do you got any? You know, we're looking for people, you know, to do FEMA work." And I said, well, you know, call Kansas State. I mean, they're the, you know, and she said, well, we love them. We love those guys. Problem is, those guys don't want to live in Indiana. They want to live in Kansas.
That's true.
That's also so great. I'm thrilled. I should be tooting my own horn. I'm always looking for I run this place kind of by myself as a full-time employee, very reliant on student employees. And you know, right now I've got a really good, I got three of them that do great work for me. One of them's getting ready to graduate, so you know, I'm always looking for good help, and I'm more than happy to teach people that are interested in getting into the feed mill industry. I will say this, I've been very, very fortunate in learning this job. Guy by the name of Brian Hawkins. This is the, you can see that. It's an owner's manual for the feed mill. It was written fall of 1984. Brian Hawkins was an undergrad student at the time, and then Mel Matheson was the original manager here for 30 years. And there's a professor here, Bruce McKenzie, who I'm not familiar with.
I know who he was. Yes. He was in ag engineering, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Okay. So Brian Hawkins, I had this job for about 2 years. Also, some guy shows up and he's working for Provimi, formerly Aiki. They're out of Ohio.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course.
And he shows up. He says, "Hey, my name's Brian Hawkins." He says, "Do you have a manual in your female?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And he says, "Well, was my name ring a bell?" And I'm like, "Is your name on that manual?" Yeah. He wrote the manual. Well, it turns out he spent the next 30 years or, most of his career running, being involved in feed manufacturing, worked his way up, ran a feed mill in Iowa that my cousin, her husband hauled from. He was best friends with my cousin's husband.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, he helped me a lot. Jan McTaggart, who is a sales rep with Provimi, she's been in the swine feed industry for, I don't know how, I don't want to say how long because I'll get it wrong. People that just, I found that people in the feed industry were kind of a unique group. We're in a situation where most people have deadlines. We have hard deadlines. Animals can't not, you just can't not deliver feed.
Correct. They always have to eat.
It doesn't matter what happened that day. It doesn't matter if you didn't have power or, 20 below or 105.
Yeah, that's right.
the feed's got to go out. And so, I just feel like the feed industry, for the most part, from the people that I've dealt with and learned from, they're more than happy to share their experiences with you, their insights, and not come to you and say, "Hey, I have all the answers." They understand that, your situation's unique.
Yeah, it's very unique. Yes.
Yeah, everybody's, every mill's got its own, character to it and uniqueness. And
you're right.
Here's things that have helped us or, things we tried and did. I'll give you an example. I had a young man that worked for me. He went to work for Indiana Packers. They put up a feed mill in Peru, Indiana.
Okay.
About 6-7 years ago. He got in. They hired him. He started there about 2 months before they started making feed. 2019 crop year, it was pretty dry that year. We had good yields, but the corn definitely suffered some drought stress.
Uh-huh.
And we started grinding that year's corn crop, and man, it was just, we were powdering that stuff. I mean, it was just, we went up 2-3 screen sizes on our hammer mill, and we still couldn't get the stuff to. Well, he was there having the same problem at the mill he's running, and he said, "Well, we finally figured out is we, instead of going to the bigger screens, which didn't really help, we reduced how much corn was going in." So we tried that here, and sure enough, it worked. Our hammer mill usually runs at 40 amps. We're running at like 30.
Uh-huh.
So we reduced the amount of corn going in the hammer mill, and that helped us keep it from.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I could.
And so that was, the kind of collaboration and you know, things that have helped me immensely over the years is just being able to pick other people's brains about, you know, issues they've had. And it, obviously the Brian Hawkins, you know, the middle had not changed that much in the 20, 30 years since he'd written that, helped write that manual. So I feel very blessed and fortunate that I've had some very smart and dedicated people to lean on over the years.
And that's also very important. I mean, getting those experts who always and people, I'm not going to say just overall experts. I mean, people with experience. And as you said, a lot of us go through the same issues at the end of the day. Animals always have to eat no matter what. So
that's an unusual. I mean, most people just aren't used to that, you know.
Yeah.
It's got to happen every day. It's not optional. You know, you can't just say, well, it's been a long day. You know, I got to go home. You know, it's like, well, no.
it needs to happen. So,
yeah, feed's got to get in that bin before we leave. So
great. Mike, we're pretty much out of time here on our podcast. Thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate all your feedback and great information there to share with our audience. And with that, this concludes another episode of the Feed Science Podcast presented by Wisenetics. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast to stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review. Your feedback is very valuable for us. Until next time, this is Carlos Campabadal from the Feed Science Podcast signing off. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.